going on? It's Chris Carino. This is the Voice of the Nets podcast presented by Ticketmaster. Thank you so much for tuning in and subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. This week on the program, with training camp coming up in just a few weeks, we're going to be joined by the man who will be the new number one assistant next to Jacques Vaughn on the Nets bench, a guy that is no stranger to coaching, and he's no stranger to the NBA. But it's going to be his first ever NBA coaching job, and that's Kevin Ollie. Just like Jacques Vaughn, a native of Southern California, who came east to play college ball, Kevin Ollie came a little further east than Jacques, came all the way out to Storrs, Connecticut, and UConn, and played on, you know, the beginnings of that UConn, what has become a blue blood top-level NCAA basketball program. At the time, he went to go play for Jim Calhoun on a team that had a bunch of pros. He would eventually go on to be an assistant for Jim Calhoun, would replace the legend, and we'll talk about that in our conversation, and won a national championship as a head coach. And in between, played with a lot of different NBA players for a lot of different NBA coaches. 13 NBA seasons with 11 different franchises. A couple of stints at Philadelphia, played with the Sonics and then with the Thunder at the end of his career. I always say, when you're around that long and you play for so many teams, you maybe aren't a good enough player that they're going to build around you or want to have you a part of the program long term. But you're a good enough person that they want in that locker room, that they want on that bench. And so many different people must talk about you and how great you are to be around and want to be with you that they'll put you on their team. His last year in the league with the Oklahoma City Thunder was with all those great young players like Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden. And it was Kevin Durant who said that Kevin Ollie was responsible for changing the culture. And we'll talk about that. And what you'll come away from listening to Kevin Ollie is he's a motivator. He's going to get you pumped up on this Tuesday morning or whenever you're listening to this. So as training camp approaches, we get ready for the new NBA season. A deep dive with the newest Nets assistant coach, his life, his motivation. It's Kevin Ollie on the Voice of the Nets. I don't know if you or anybody you know plays this. I play this game all the time on my phone. I'm obsessed with the crossover grid or a thing called the immaculate grid. Mm-hmm. Have you heard about it? I don't know if you've heard of this. Have you?
No.
So what it is basically, the NBA version will have a tic-tac-toe kind of grid with teams on one parallel, teams on the other. And where they cross, you have to put in a player who played for both organizations.
Okay.
So you are like a go-to.
Yes.
Because
yes, I'll probably there's win that one.
Yeah, like if you pull out the immaculate grid right now, Kevin Ollie is probably an answer to half the grid.
Yeah, it's true.
What, 11 franchises?
Yeah, 11. Some say 12 because of
Seattle and Oklahoma City.
So,
and that's over a period of 13 years.
13 years. Yeah, it was five teams my first 2 years, because once you sign a 10-day contract and they don't keep you after the two 10-day contracts, it's considered a team. So, you know, going back down to the CBA, Continental Basketball Association, as it was called then, it was just, you know, it was a fight. And that became my friend, you know, and that became the reason why I'm here today. So I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed when I was going through it, but when I look back on it, it really paved my journey into the man I am today.
The fact that you could hook up with so many teams, maybe you weren't a star, you didn't maybe, I don't know, whatever they were looking for, but they liked having you around. Did you get that sense, or is that hard to see early on in your career?
No, it was kind of evident. I look at it as being a star in being a star in your role, instead of being a superstar. And I always thought about, you know, me, like, am I getting to the Hall of Fame? No, but I always use HOF as my Hall of Fame, and that's hope, optimism, and faith. So that kind of kept me going through my 12, 13 years, through the ups and downs, where people kind of perceive where, you know, it was a downtime. But, you know, at the end of the day, that made me who I am. Remember getting cut on Christmas Eve in Dallas. And then coming back, playing in Philadelphia, and then getting snapped by Larry Brown. So imagine if I'd have got to January and then, you know, Eric Snow didn't bust his thumb open, I wouldn't have been in Philadelphia. I just think everything happens for a reason. And I thank God for putting me in those situations where I was able to just succeed and just fight through. And through that adversity, it just made me strong, because life will throw you some weights, but it's like up to you. Can you lift them? And I just always had the mindset I'm going to lift them. Just coming from my background, coming from Los Angeles, going all the way across the country to Connecticut, everybody thought I'd be back in like 2 weeks. I just always wanted to do something different. I kind of like a radical mindset. I never wanted to be comfortable. So I think in that, it made me a viable commodity to a lot of teams, and, you know, just trying to be that type of player that players can look at, you know, be example on the court, but then also be example off the court. And I think I found my niche doing that. But at the same time, Chris, I want to compete now. I was going to make me some minutes somewhere. Even my 13th year in the league, I was going to play some minutes. So, you know, I just never came in like just a guy that was just going to be on the bench.
No, and I there's so many things I want to get into, because you mentioned Larry Brown, and I know you've played for so many great coaches. You've had an incredible amount of teammates. I would love to just look in your phone one day, all the contacts, because you play with half the league and other coaches. But let's go back in the beginning, though, because you brought it up. So let's get back there, because to tell someone's story, their journey, you want to know where their origin story was from. You were from Crenshaw in L.A., but your dad also, your dad had lived in Dallas, so you would spend your summers in Dallas, and you were growing up in Crenshaw. A dichotomy, a diverse sort of area there between Dallas is sort of, you know, you can mow lawns and things like that. And Crenshaw is a little bit of a difference. How did that kind of shape the kind of person you were?
It was everything. I give a lot of credit to my mom, because they got divorced. My mom and dad got divorced when I was four. And, you know, being in Oak Cliff, getting born in Oak Cliff, Dallas, Oak Cliff, Texas, and being in Dallas, Fort Worth area, moving out to L.A., my mom could easily been like, okay, my relationship with your dad is this, and I'm going to put that on you, you know, and you don't need to see him, because whatever was going on, I don't even want to get in that, but I don't know.
But
I
she
was
just realized it's important.
It's important for you to have your father in your life. And at the end of the day, I didn't want you to spend a day in a summer in L.A. So, like, right after school, that first week, I was playing with my friends, and then after that second week out of for summer, I was going to Dallas. And it just really helped me from a working standpoint, getting up, cutting lawns in the morning, beating the sun up, getting up at 4 o'clock, being wherever we was at 5, putting the gas in the lawnmowers and cutting big apartments.
This is working with your dad?
Working with my dad. Okay. He has a lawnmower service. He still has it to this day. And it just taught me the work ethic about getting up in the morning, beating the sun up, and not waiting for your alarm clock to get you up, and just the hard work and the dedication. But I owe it all to my mom. And then, you know, learning basketball was from my mom. I mean, she drove around the whole L.A. looking for the best, you know, league, whatever you call it, AAU back then. I don't know what they call it back then. We was just getting started in the AAU, but whatever league was the best, she wanted me there. And that's where I found a lot of my mentors, my coaches, you know, starting at the seventh grade, because I played football, you know, till the seventh grade, and I really just started concentrating on basketball. But it was for my mom driving around whole L.A. If she wouldn't have did that, I wouldn't have been in this seat or have the career that I had. Just that, you know, just that pour of love and, like, you're going to do this, and, you know, I'm going to put you in a situation, and then you're going to have to – You're gonna have to make a table out of this tree that I planted. So, and that was just a great thing that she did, and I just really respect her to this day. Rest her soul. She's been dead for she's been transitioned to heaven for 2 years now, but she is a big part of my life.
And there's your mom, Dorothy, who was she a minister?
Yeah, she was ordained minister, assistant pastor at our church. So, yeah, we was in church all Sunday.
I could see that in you a little bit. Is that where kind of, because you're if people see you on the internet, there's you giving speeches to your players and things like that. There's a little minister thing going on there. I guess you got that from your mom as well.
Yeah, I got that from my mom. Just watching her in the pulpits and how she changed people's lives from just her words and, you know, where it came from and her encouragement and her faithfulness, you know, seeing her pray for me and my two sisters when we was out doing all kind of other things, just seeing how faithful she was to her Christianity really played a big part of my life.
And then, you know, when you would go out to Dallas in the summertime, I guess it was a way she didn't have to worry about you either.
No.
Not having stuff to do or the pitfalls that could be in the area of L.A. where you were.
Yes. Yeah, and, you know, it's pitfalls anywhere, but my dad is like, if you see my dad, he's like 6'7", about 280. So I'm not going to do too much with him. Yeah. So I was like, we lied there. Yeah, now. He kept me. Only thing he had to do was like look at me one way and I jump right back in position.
That's a great lesson, though, because, you know, you think, you know, listen, a lot of marriages break up and there's kids and that's always complicated.
Right.
But you understand the kids need a mother and a father.
Yes.
And there may be differences between the parents, but at least they both recognize that we're not going to put that on you. Right. We're going to let you grow up with each of us.
Right, right. And that's like a lesson that stays with me today.
Sure.
You know, being with my wife for 18 years and getting divorced, but still being amicable and seeing how my mom and my dad handled that situation, you can pass that on, you know. So that's like a big thing for me, always to look at those lessons. And success always leaves clues. If you look at success and things like that, you can pick those up and add them to your life and present them when it's time to be presented.
We don't always see the clues, though, when they're going on.
No.
It's hard.
No, you have to be aware of them and recognize them and, you know, pick them up and, you know, live your life. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of people around you that gives you a lot of gold nuggets that you got to take in consideration. And when your time is, you got to do and say what aligns with your life. And, you know, what I say and what I do is being grateful first and foremost and having my faith and, you know, standing on what I say I was going to do. And I think that's a true character of a man.
So how does Kevin Ollie, who's a basketball star in L.A., and spending his time in the summers in Texas, how did those two incredible basketball states with colleges that are competitive, how did they let you get out of the state and get all the way to UConn?
Yeah, Coach
Stores,
Calhoun.
Connecticut.
Coach Calhoun came in and, you know, with Howie Dickerman, I remember they coming into my living room and Howie Dickerman and Coach Lado. They just, I mean, it was something about them, man. It was something about them, what I felt in their spirit. I knew they was going to take care of me more, not just as a basketball player, but as a man. And it was something that was surreal. I went down to Connecticut. I think they tricked me. They definitely tricked me. They brought me on my official visit when it was like 85 degrees and all that. So it was like a perfect spring day. You know how the spring days in Connecticut is like perfect.
Couple weeks.
Yeah, they didn't bring me down in November, December, nothing like that. So, you know, they tricked me there. But at the end of the day, you know, coaches always say, you know, you don't need a, you know, air conditioner or heater in the gym. You know, it's never cold in the gym. It's perfect temperature. You stay in there, you work hard, you play hard. You're going to get an opportunity here. And that's the only thing I wanted to do is get an opportunity. And the biggest thing we seen growing up, coming from Crenshaw, we see Stevie Thompson go to Syracuse. So back then it was Big Monday.
Yeah, it was a heyday.
And just, you know, every Monday, you know, you out of school, you make sure you get your homework done and you're watching Big Monday. You got a doubleheader. And it's watching the Georgetowns, watching, you know, the Connecticut was on the rise, but watching the Villanovas and, you know, the Syracuse battle and the St. John, Seton Halls and the St. John's, just seeing those battles, that was everything for us. Yeah. And I was like, if Stevie can do it, he can go to Syracuse, why not me?
And that on the West Coast, too. You were seeing that on the West Coast, right?
Seeing it on the West Coast,
I'm a New York kid, and I used to love that, too. I look forward to Big Monday, you know, and Mike Gorman and Bill Raftery doing the games.
Yeah, the games, exactly.
They're probably on it, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon out in L.A. Interesting, because the Big East was king there, but UConn wasn't what it was.
No.
At that time, you were sort of you were one of the guys that sort of changed thing. You started the ball in motion there with Jim Calhoun. What was the group there with you? How did you come?
Me, Ray Allen, Danielle Marshall came in with me. Donnie Marshall came with me. Ray Allen came in after our sophomore year, and we just had Travis Knight, Daron Sheffer. I can keep going down
got
the
to,
list.
Yeah. What was the furthest Brian you guys Ford. Got?
We got to the Elite Eight.
Right? Elite Eight, yeah, yeah.
They set us up. We played UCLA and Oakland Coliseum, so it was like a home game for them. But it was good. It was good. I think the game was like 98-102. That was like, there's no college games like that. I mean, we had so much talent on the team.
And you're playing
that
UCLA,
was Charles
right?
O'Bannon.
Your L.A. team.
Yeah. Taya Setney. It still hurts me to today because they should not have been there. Tyus Edney did that coast to coast against a Missouri, I think. So so they should have not been there. I think we'd have won the national championship if we would if they'd have got beat.
Not that you still don't think about it.
I still don't think about it. I won a national championship, so it made up for it.
What are great players you played against in high school in LA? Did you run into Jacques Vaughn at all in LA?
Yes, yes. Okay. You know, I don't wanna we beat Jacques now. It's 10th grade. He was 10th grade and I was a senior. Okay. So back then, we didn't start in the 9th grade. We started in the 10th grade. So Jacques was a superstar, you know, all the way up. And, you know, I think I played Jacques. I think it was 10th grade year. We played against each other, Crenshaw against John Muir. Yeah.
Similar situation. He's getting a call. You know, you're out there in L.A., and I'm sure you could go to UCLA, USC, yep. and he's going to Kansas.
Yeah, yeah, you know? He went to Kansas. Yeah,
but Roy Williams is hard to.
Yeah, it's hard to turn that down. And once you get to those campuses, like Connecticut, we just all stayed together. It was a family atmosphere. And it was like, you know, I went to other schools, but it wasn't a tight group like that. And I just fell in love with it. And then they played the style of play we played. Like, you know, that was back then. You know, you got Husky Mania, you pressing on makes and misses. That's the same thing that we did at Crenshaw with Willie West teams. So it was just perfect with me, and it just aligned. And then I just wanted to be free. You know, I wanted to wear red sometimes. You know, back then we could just wear blue at Crenshaw because of the area gangs, and the gangs and all that stuff. But I wanted to wear red sometimes. And, like, at Connecticut, nobody cared about that stuff. The cows didn't care about it once you came across Storrs campus. The cows didn't care about what you wore. So it was, like, perfect, man. It was just somewhere to get away, and I always wanted to bet on myself. So it was a beautiful thing.
Was growing up in L.A., though, where when you're a star basketball player like that, is there kind of a sense of, hey, let's nurture the kid, or let's protect him rather than have you fall into the dangers that are there? Did you experience that?
Yeah. I mean, walking to school sometimes, you know, they come up to me, what set you claim? That was like the biggest question we was at. What set you claim? Like, I play ball. So that was like the biggest thing. I'm not in a gang. I just play ball. And they always recognize me playing ball. And, you know, that was the biggest thing. But, you know, I was protected. But at the end of the day, you had to have your GPS on because every block was different. You know, like every block was different. So you couldn't be walking on a certain block. So I always had my antennas up. That's the point guard in me. And I always kind of sense when danger was there. Hmm. You know, even in house parties or different things like that, I always found like a sense of, you know, of danger, and I was able to get out in certain situations, and I think God had his hands on me in certain situations that I did get out where other people got trapped. So, you know, I thank God for that as well.
So you get out, you go all the way across to UConn. You mentioned your mom, and one of my favorite stories that I've heard was when you first get to Storrs, you're a little homesick.
Yes.
And you call your mom, and you're kind of like almost putting a seed out there that maybe this is a mistake. Mm. I want to come home. Yeah. And I love the fact that she just hung up on you. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. It wasn't like I was putting it out there. I was telling her I want to come home.
I want to come home.
I want to come home.
She didn't want to have any of it.
She didn't want to hear nothing of it. It was like the first storms, you know, the school was going. We had this great point guard called Chris Smith. Coach Calhoun put me against him one-on-one, and we had this full court drill that we used to go one-on-one, and anybody know Chris Smith, he had this low crossover, and he was just crossing me up, and I remember that day, I never stopped. He was scoring on me, but I never stopped, and Coach Calhoun told me I'm never going to get out the drill till you stopped him. So we was going back and forth, and he was scoring, but I was giving him my all, and I think that really showed Coach what I'm about. But when I got out of that practice, I was just like, nah, I think this not for me. Coach Calhoun has this Boston accent, so I didn't understand a word he was saying, but I did understand certain things, and I was like, man, did he really call me that? Going back to my dorm, and I was kind of like shedding a tear. I called my mom. I was like, I made a mistake, Ma. I want to come back home. And first thing she said is like, no, you made this decision. You're going to stick through it, and you're going to live it out, and you're going to be okay. And I'm like, Mom, I want to come home. Bam. She said what she had to say, and then I heard a dial tone, and then ever since then, I didn't call her about transferring or anything like that. I just stuck it out, believed the champion in me and the different things that she instilled in me and my dad instilled in me, and then it worked itself out. And after my sophomore year, I started every game.
And she knew what you were about. So she was making that decision for you that you maybe didn't have the courage to make.
Yes,
because I don't know. I'm a parent of a college kid, and you know my son went to college last year, and it's hard. I don't know if I would have the, you know, you want to help your kid, like if they're hurting and they're, but she knew. I mean, that's a hard decision as a parent when she knows, she hears the fear probably, or the, you know, how sad you were at that moment, and she gave you the tough love that you needed, and it turned out to be the best thing you could have ever done.
Yeah, and I use the word love tough instead of tough love. So I like to lead with love. She was leaving with love, but she was tough behind it too. And most times, you know, I have kids, and when they were small, you know, they crying, you want to pick them up.
Yeah.
But her job was to pick me up, but not, you know, give me a pass though. Pick me up, but not give me a pass to walk out and do something and avert my dreams. And she told me, you made the decision. Like, she actually wanted me to go to UCLA. You know, I kind of chose UConn. So she was just like, okay.
You were the one who wanted to go over to Storrs, Connecticut.
Yeah, so hers was between UCLA and UConn. And I kind of pushed UConn because I didn't want to stay in the same area, be around the same friends. I wanted to do something different. So it was kind of on me. I made that last decision, so.
And it wasn't so much homesick then, it sounds like, as like you got in a situation now that you'd never been in your basketball life, was that you probably were always the best kid, and you know, you're always one of the best high school players, and now you're going up against kids and you're like, whoa, wait a minute, like, am I good enough to be here? Was that sort of a crisis of confidence for you at that moment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you doubt yourself a little bit. You doubt yourself, you being 3,000 miles away from home. I mean, it was a lot of different things. It's cold. I mean, it was a lot of things I wasn't used to. Like all that adversity and what I thought was problems became my promise and became my purpose. So now I look back on it, man, that was like a pebble in the sand. Like I look back on it, like that really shaped who I was, because I didn't give in. I didn't give up. I stood on my two feet and I made a lifetime connections. Like I have the East Coast, the West Coast, like you say, in my Rolodex, I got so many relationships from being able to jump out of my comfort zone and be in the midst of everything going around. And I just always believe in, you know, when it's a whirlwind or a storm or something, it's always the eye of the hurricane. And how can you get in that eye of the hurricane where it's calm, where it's all kind of distractions around you? And I really found myself putting myself in that position throughout. So, you know, that toughness and, you know, that championship in me.
Being comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Is kind of something I think that's a key to happiness in life.
Yeah.
Knowing that it's not always going to be calm and stormy, but you know you can get through it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just part of it, though. Yeah. I don't think like failure is the opposite of success. I really don't believe. I just think failure is part of it. You know, maybe that day I felt like a failure, but that's just one moment. And, you know, you feel that way and then you get back up and you go back at it again. And I just, it's how I live my life.
What happened? So you said like that day you were getting crushed in practice. Was there something now, another time where it went the other way, where all of a sudden now you got your confidence back?
Yeah, I just showed up the following day.
Like it was the next day?
Yeah, he's like, that's
your
what Coach Calhoun
did. Your mom hung up on you and you said, that's it. There's no option anymore.
There's no more options. It's not going back home. You got to figure this thing out. Yeah. And then we get back on the line and we start running and Coach Calhoun start cussing. And that's just what it was, you know, but he was getting the best out of us, you know. And then the competition every day, it just bred the killer in me. You know, and then I just started going back to my Crenshaw days. You know, my conditioning was like one of the best on the team. So, you know, sooner or later, those guys was going to get tired. And I just was able to outwill them. And, you know, Coach brought in point guards every year. Every year I was there, he pointed another point guard. Yeah. But I was just like, at the end of the day, they're going to play beside me. I'm not going nowhere. And I became one of the anchors and one of the one of the persons that he relied on throughout my 4 years. And we won a lot of games in that 4 year span.
Yeah, and helped launch what would become a long period of time there. Where and then, I don't want to jump ahead to what it was like to then replace Jim Calhoun and win a national championship there as a coach.
Yeah.
Because so much happened in between. It wasn't like you left college and bounced around for Europe a couple of years and then went on the staff. I mean, you end up, like we said, the CBA, 13 years in the NBA, 11 different franchises before you eventually get back to coaching. So let's just go through your NBA journey a little bit. Now, you I'm sure coming out of UConn, you maybe had that dream of being an NBA star. But you have to go to the CBA first.
Yeah.
So what kept you going with that dream?
My son being born. That really kept me going and put my life in perspective. You know, he was born with a birth defect and was bedstricken for the first 6 weeks of his life. And I just found myself in a room outside of the hospital and just was like, you know, God, if you give him breath, you know, I'm going to change my life and I'm going to work towards you. And, you know, you're going to give me the strength to get through this. And, you know, to this day, you know, I tell him all the time, you know, like if it wasn't for you and what you went through and the strength you showed me, I wouldn't be here today as well. So all these little things in my life gave me, you know, a clear vision on what I need to do or put my life in perspective. So, you know, just having him and knowing like this little guy's depending on you. You know, you got to keep the lights on. You got to keep, you know, a roof over their head. So, you know, me, my wife, Stephanie, my ex-wife, Stephanie, we just band together. And, you know, she supported me. She took care of home. I was out there working, you know, for the Connecticut Pride. I was drafted in the first round there. Didn't get drafted in the NBA. What helped me, that was still in Connecticut. So we played our games in the Civic Center, which was called the Civic Center then. So it was kind of familiar with me. Yeah. So just being in Connecticut, having all the connections and the relationships I had made it kind of the transition easier to me and playing 2 years straight in the CBA. And back then, a lot of guards wasn't going overseas. We had Ramil Robertson, Tate George, we had Chris Childs, we had John, like we had some guards there. Yeah. Like we was playing, you was playing against some elite guards every day. So that allowed me to play with the great competition. And, you know, I think the biggest thing for me was not comparing myself. I think the first 2 years I see somebody get called up and be like, wow, that's not me. You know, I just ran circles around this guy.
Why him, not me?
Yeah, and once I decided not to do that, Chris, I had my worst game ever. I think I was 1-for-13. And I was like, man, Kevin, you ain't never getting called up. And 3 days later, I got called up. And I was like, that's an oxymoron. Like, come on, bro. Seriously. And it's just how life changes.
Yeah,
and
it gave you a little lesson.
Yeah, it just gave me a lesson. Like, it happens, you know. And
but
you
also, you're not judged on your worst day. You know, like, you got to, like, know there, you've built a lot into this.
Yes.
Don't kill yourself too much for a 1-for-13 day.
Yes, and have compassion, but just don't compare yourself to other people. Mm. Because some of those guys that got 10-day contracts before me or got caught up didn't make 13 years in the league. I did. And it just told me a great lesson that I try to pass down to everybody. Don't compare yourself to anybody. Your day will come. You just got to keep planting the seeds. And it's just the perspective you have on life. Because most people say, okay, you buried or you planted. You can choose whichever one you want to. But I feel like every time some dirt is thrown on me, I'm planted to be something greater.
You got strength from having a family early on there, like you said. Did they because you were moving around so much, were they always with you or did they go to one place and kind of, did you try and give them stability? Like, what was that like?
Early on in my career, they was moving with me.
Yeah.
Me and Stephanie at the time decided we were going to, you know.
Be together.
But then also my last 7 years, I signed my first big contract. So my first 7 years I signed make good contracts. Yeah. So it was that January, I remember the day, I think it was like January 10th. We was able, if you stay on the con, if you still on the team, you get signed guaranteed. Fortunately, the first 7 years I made the date, but I never had a multi-year deal till, you know, I played for Milwaukee with George Karl, got traded in mid-season with Ray Allen to Seattle, played very, very well. And then Paul Silas, rest his soul, signed me for a 5-year deal in Cleveland Cavaliers, LeBron's rookie year. Mm. Played there.
That only lasted a year.
Yeah. Bought my first house. I thought I was set. I mean,
the money was there.
Yeah, the money was there. And then I got traded to Philadelphia, and I was like, all right, I'm done. I'm done. I thought 5-year deal, I have some kind of stability. And then they moved back to Connecticut because they was getting older. Kind of wanted to keep them in the same routine, school like that, friends, curriculum. And then here come God doing oxymoron. This is the first time I stayed with a team for four straight years with 76ers.
Yeah.
But that was back when the Southwest had the little $39 you can go right
go
there. I could go back and forth. So it worked out pretty good.
Yeah, that was the end of your career. It was the first time you actually spent consecutive seasons with one team.
Yeah, Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
And then the next 2 years, I think I went to Minnesota for a 1-year deal, and then Oklahoma City for a 1-year deal, and that was it.
You had a brief stop with the Nets.
I did, yeah.
That was 2000-2001 season.
So yes.
Byron Scott was his first year, I believe, yep. Right? But the year before, Jason Kidd comes in and everything mm-hmm. gets turned around. But I would imagine now it's a much different organization than when I'm still here. We got a chance to say hello.
Yeah, we're still here, yeah.
But not too many others. I mean, you know, yeah. Aaron Harris maybe, who was another UConn guy.
Yeah, Aaron's still there.
But other than that, it's a very different place that you find from the last time you were here.
That was a funny story in that training camp. I mean, I think you had all guaranteed contracts. And I'm like, Bill Neff, that was my agent. Like, why the hell are you sending me to New Jersey? Because everybody's under contract. Like, there's no spots for me. He's just, trust me. Just go in there, work hard, do what you have to do. You know, I'm putting you here for a reason. And, you know, I think Elliot Perry had a guaranteed contract, I believe. And I think for like $2.5 million or something like that. I think Sherman Douglas was there. We was loaded with guard. Stephon Marbury was there. And they let someone go. I think they let Elliot Perry go and kept me.
Rod Thorne had just started.
Yeah,
at that
Rod
time.
Thorne
Byron
just started.
Scott.
Byron Scott. And, you know, it was just all guaranteed contracts. And I just, like, once again, I just put my head down and I just worked out. I just worked and believed in my work ethic. And some way, somehow, I made a team. And that's just been kind of my career. After that, you know, I was just making teams just with the will and the hard work and the desire. And I think my name kind of preceded itself around the league.
And you see where it was, the Nets were at that time, out in East Rutherford and playing at Izod Center. And now here, you know, you come in now, I mean, it's so different. You're in Brooklyn, you know, everybody's different.
Yes.
But, this is the first time that you're coming into an NBA organization as a coach.
Yes.
So what were your first impressions when you walked in the door, and what made you choose Brooklyn now to come
back? Yeah, it was beautiful. You know, just walking in, talking to JV, you know, understanding what he really wants for this program, what he wants for his players, but his relationship with Sean Marks, being here for 7 years, I think 7-8 years.
As an assistant
coach, already, kind of knowing the people. Knowing the organization, knowing behind the basketball, behind you know, the scenes and everything. It was just something that I really wanted to do. Of course, I was up for the Detroit Pistons job, and going through that was a great scrimmage for me. You know, that was awesome, being the last couple guys, you know, that they was interviewing there. And then, you know, it was just an opportunity for me to come back to the East Coast. Love the situation that they had here, love the young players that they had, the versatility that they had, seeing what they did at the end of the season when JV took over, just the camaraderie, playing tough basketball, something that aligns with me, and just knowing what Jock's all about. You know, he's a stand-up guy. You know, he's not going to say nothing and not stand on it. And I just believe that his point guard pedigree speaks for itself. You know, his basketball acumen speaks for itself. Being their head coach, probably learning from the Orlando Magic situation, now coming in this situation, you know, it's just somebody that I can really learn from and serve. And I just want to come serve him. I want to serve the players. I want to serve this organization. And the other thing, my kids both live here. You know, my son lives in Brooklyn.
Okay.
He's a Fordham graduate.
I love it already.
Yeah, he lives in Brooklyn now. He works for J.P. Morgan. My daughter just graduated from Wesleyan, got a biochemical job in the World Trade Center. She's in East Village, right across the bridge from me. So it was like, perfect. It was kind of perfect. Like,
yeah.
I wouldn't, in my dreams, I wouldn't have thought of like, okay, after college, I'm going to be in the same state. Same 17 miles from my kids.
Yeah,
that wasn't even crossing my mind. And to have that set up, I mean, that's like, you got to take that. I try to live my life without regrets and minimize my regrets. So when I turn 80, I look back on my life, I'll be like, damn, like, you didn't take that Brooklyn job and your kids was there, I will regret that.
Yeah. You mentioned your son had health issues early on.
Yeah.
Is that something that was with him throughout his life? Or
yeah, he has surgery.
Okay.
The disease called, you know, gastroschisis, where you kind of have a hole in your stomach and, they sutured it up, put him on a silo. He was bed stricken for six weeks and now you couldn't even tell.
Okay.
So it really made me understand and really gave me some life lessons to teach him. He was like a lot of embarrassed, you know, sometimes going younger where he had to go to the pool, he had to take his shirt off. Mm-hmm. I was like, you never be embarrassed of that scar because you made me the man who I am with that scar. Never be embarrassed of that scar because those scars are the ones that take you and you can look back on those scars and say, man, I got through that. So, you know, that situation and being around him and being able to have him around at the games and my daughter around the games, I just thought it would be something I needed to do. I will regret that if I turn 80. God gives me the health to stay at 80. I will regret this big time. So I took the leap of faith, decided to come on down, and you know it's been a blessing.
There's a Rumi quote that I love. The scars are the place where the light enters you.
Yeah.
You know, your career, you talk about serving, you know, coming here and serving others. That was kind of your career as a point guard. You know, you're a playmaker. But also I felt like your whole NBA career was a little bit like you were working toward coaching. Like when I think of your time at Oklahoma City late in your career, your last year, right? You had that group with Harden and Durant and Westbrook.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Durant said that you were single-handedly the guy who changed the culture there.
Mm.
I mean, you were there for a year.
Right.
Like, did you, you said, you know, knowing going into a situation, what I can bring and what my role is, was that sort of, did you see yourself as a coach? You see yourself as a culture shifter? I mean, how did you, why would he say something like that, do you think?
I never came in there like I'm about to shift the culture. I just was being my authentic self, being Kevin Ollie, you know, extending myself, you know, showing compassion to others, trying to empower others. I just never looked at myself as, you know, I think how you aspire, how you great is how do you make the other person beside you feel. And I always wanted to make that person feel like they're the only one in the room or they can do anything. So just giving them those encouraging words, being there for them. I mean, we had so much talent, you know, in practice, but, you know, also, you know, how do we, you know, not get caught up in just the talent? How do we outwork the talent each and every day? You know, that's what the one thing I wanted to bring. How do you outlast your talent? Because sometimes we're going to get to a point where talent is just not good enough.
Mm.
It's like the character that you have and not your achievements. It's about the character that you bring each and every day. And I wanted to teach those guys that, how to be a professional, no matter what, the ups and downs, winning and losing. No, it's about how do we show up every day and protect what's ours. And
players, you know, all talk to each other, and you've been around the league for so long at that point. I'm sure it was your reputation of, you know, hey, pick this guy's brain when he comes in, young players. I mean,
yeah.
You're with LeBron when he started.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to be something that gets around. Who was your vet, like, early on? Who were the guys that you played with early on that you learned from?
Yeah, Derek Harper, A.C. Green, you know, guys like that that was just around and just putting their arms around me, showing me this is how you do it. Charles Oakley in Chicago, playing with him, just seeing his leadership and his toughness. So guys like that I always looked at, you know, Sherman Douglas's of the world, you know, just guys like that. Like, how Sherman stayed in the league, you know, like he's not jumping, dunking on people or nothing like that, but just his craftiness and how he did every day, what his routine was, and just picking their brains. So I had some great veteran guys that really showed me leadership, showed me how to do certain things and, you know, understand my role and understand my path. But, you know, even in my 76ers days, you know, like me and Eric Snow are same age, but just looking at Eric Snow, you know, and coming in Philadelphia, like, man, he can do this. Like, just looking at guys like that. So it wasn't like all these old veterans. It was some of my peers, too, that I really looked at and said, man, I can, you know, not be Eric Snow, but I can mirror some of the things he do and how he's carving out this situation, you know, in the 76ers, and him being a starting point guard really helped me as well.
A great Sherman Douglas story I remember when he was with the Nets. Remember Hal Whistle was here as a coach, right? Yeah, so Hal was telling me a story one time about Sherman first shows up, like first night, comes to the Nets and whatever it is, and suits up and gets out there and plays. Didn't even know the plays or anything. And they said he went out and he's coming down the court and he's just yelling out, you know, thumb opposite or something like that. And after the game, Hal Whistle goes, Sherman, what were you calling? Like, you don't even, that's not even a play. He goes, well, I was making the other team think it was a play and giving the scouts something to think about. Like, he's already just thinking about that.
Right.
I guess that keeps you in the league, too, being smart. Right.
Yeah, being smart, being an extension of the coach. You know, I had one thing with Larry Brown. You know, I didn't play a lot of minutes, but I played, you know, 20, 25 minutes some games. I never wanted to look at Larry Brown. I wanted to be so in tune with him that I knew, okay, we need to get Matamo to basketball. I need to get AI to basketball. I need to do certain things. And only in timeouts, you know, now he can draw up a play. But I wanted to be so in tune with him. Like, I got this, coach. Like, me and you are so connected right now. I know exactly what you want, exactly what you're thinking about.
He's a guy you bring up a lot when you talk about coaching. What did he mean to you?
He mean everything to me.
Yeah.
You know, the first time I got there, you know, I was on a 10-day contract. We stretching. It was around Thanksgiving time. He invited me over to Thanksgiving. I'm like, nah, me? You invite me to Thanksgiving? You barely know me. Like, you're not talking to me. Allen Iverson, Aaron McKee could go over to Thanksgiving. You don't know me. But just for him to have and to recognize that and awareness that I'm new, and I probably don't have anybody in Philly, where you going to eat at? You know, and things like that. I mean, that's everything to me. That's more than just being a coach. That's being, you know, a person that you can count on, a person that cares, a person that's compassionate. And you run through the wall for coaches like that. And that's where I get that. Like, it can't just be this basketball, you know, relationship. I got to know what you stand for as a person. I got to know your family. I got to know, you know, your whys and what makes you go. And not only what makes you tick, but what makes you talk. You know, I think when you start talking to a person, they trust you.
I always hear about Larry Brown. They would say, like, he would coach the 15th, 16th guy as hard as he would coach Allen Iverson.
Yes, that's a true story.
Yeah.
You know, Allen wasn't coming to all the practices. And we, you know, back then you had 4 games and 5 nights. We had a lot of, you know, not days off, but, you know, it wasn't days off for us. You know, we come in and play 3-on-3. And I think he got more satisfaction coaching our 3-on-3 than he did in playoff games. Like, for real. Like, seriously, he'll coach our 3-on-3s like it was like game 7. We playing the Lakers game 7. And all of us got contracts. I mean, Todd McCullough's, Jermaine Jones's, Ira Bowman's, Roger Bell's. Like, all of our guys, we played 3-on-3. Nas Muhammad. Like, all of us played 3-on-3. We all got contracts because of what he instilled in us in those 3-on-3s, how to play the right basketball, how to pass to an open teammate, make cuts, be selfless, and all those different things I owe to Larry Brown.
Mm. Then you get called, you know, you finish your playing days, and now again, it's UConn calling.
Yeah.
You know, what was your thought process? Did you ever think, maybe I don't know if I should do that, or is it Jim Calhoun called and again, you're going to Stores?
Yeah, no, I had some big decisions to make. Because Sam Presti was so good to me. That organization was so good to me.
He was just kind of starting at that time.
Yeah, and I was like, man, should I stay here?
Was that an option for you?
That was definitely an option for me. Yeah. He gave me an option to stay in the organization, you know, a coach or, you know, pursue front office. He gave me an option to do both of them and just be in the organization some way, somehow, wherever you feel fit. But then again, it just came down to my family. You know, I've been in Oklahoma City, Minnesota, they wasn't there. You know, 4 years in Philadelphia, they wasn't there. And it's just different, Chris, when you come in after, you know, 8 months gone, and then you come in like, all right, you try to do it. You need to do this. You need to wake up at this time. You haven't even been here. And Pop's like, yeah, what you talking about?
Yeah,
I got my routine already. Now you coming here 4 months and trying to lay down the law. Like, nah, hold up. So I just felt that. And, you know, all my whole career, not that I chose my career over my family. It was just something that I love to do. And, of course, I had to go with a contract. So me and Stephanie made this, you know, the decision that we was going to make the sacrifices, not our kids make the sacrifices. But that was the first time my opportunity. I was just like, I'm going to come back home, you know, be with my kids, you know.
Stephanie was from Connecticut, right?
She's from Connecticut, yeah. So she was back at, you know, back, you know, from Bridgeport, Connecticut. She was back home. And I just decided to do that. It was a hard decision. But, you know, to come back and coach for your alma mater, you know, learn from Coach Calhoun, be there at UConn and be able to represent that, you know, that great university again was something that I had to do. And like I say, I would have regretted it if I didn't do it. And you know, it was some great times in stores.
Yeah, and you're the guy that, you know, replaces a legend.
Yes.
And that can be hard sometimes to do. But you win a national championship.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, even before the national championship, you know, I mean, we took over a program that was, you know, Coach Calhoun leaving. The Big East was dismantling. We was on something called APR. It was a academic progress report. We didn't do well in that. So we was banned for the pro season. You know, recruiting was not good because they was using all these different things that go against us, not being able to be in the, you know, in the NCAA tournament, and people saying we're not going to be in the NCAA tournament for 4 years, and all kind of stuff was going around. So us going to a new league called the AAC that nobody heard of. So it was a lot of different things going around at that time. And, you know, I was just like, okay, let's band together. And like all these situations, where is the eye of the hurricane? You know, how do I calm myself down? How do I understand that this is here for me? This was put in my life to bring the champion out of me. And that's what we did. And, you know, I remember the first day standing up and Coach Calhoun retired, and I stand up front of the team and, you know, saying my speeches and, you know, that what we going to play for, and we're going to play for the pride of what's on the front of our jersey. And Shabazz just stand up after I said my little speech and saying, I'm going to stand right here with you, Coach. And
that
after
Shabazz
that, it was the, it was everything else was history then. You know, Ryan Boatwright got on board, and we made some runs. And that first year, we went 20-10 in the Big East. When nobody thought we didn't have nothing to play for, because we wasn't going to the tournament. We was a tournament team. That was the last year of the Big East. We could have easily just folded the tent. But, you know, we just didn't believe in that. We didn't believe in folding the tent. We didn't believe in giving in. We believed this was what's going to propel us for something greater. And it did. And the following year, we won a national championship, ironically, in AT&T Stadium in front of 82,000 people.
The NBA comes calling at that time. But your family situation, like wanting to give that stability, like they sacrificed for so long, was that part of your wanting to stay in Connecticut?
Yes, that was a big part of it. And, you know, to be totally transparent, me and my wife was going through a divorce. So I wanted to
be there for
my kids, because I didn't know how they was going to react. And they was a little older, which made it a little better. Because they probably have friends that went through that situation. Mm. They can talk to their friends about it, but I just wanted to be there for my family. Cleveland, the Lakers, a lot of teams was knocking at my door, but I wanted to stay loyal to UConn. And after I won a national championship, I just didn't want to leave those guys like a Ryan Boatwright that was coming back for a senior year.
What was the biggest thing you took away from Jim Calhoun and that might shape you as a coach?
Yeah, perseverance. You know, just – he's just a tough, he got something about him where, you know, it just brings the best out of you. And he pushes you and pushes you and pushes you and gets something out of you that you never thought you had in you. And that was one thing that he always, you know, told me, you know, he's just going to push me and get me past possible. Every day I just always wanted to get past possible. And he pushed me to do that. He gave me opportunities. He was fair. But at the end of the day, he was very, he was tough and he was demanding. I like to use the word challenging because I see when I hear the word challenge, I feel a championship opportunity in that. So I always want to feel, I always want to say the word challenging. He was very challenging every day. He didn't let me take any shortcuts. And I think, you know, that's where I got the kind of the quote from is like, we're going to take the stairs and not the elevator. He didn't believe in no elevators. We was going to take the stairs and we was going to learn every step in our venture to be successful. So that was one of the greatest things that I learned from Jim.
Again, the minister kind of comes out at you at times, and there's been a lot of great, you know, videos people could see online of you giving speeches to your kids, you know, the overtime elite kids or the college students, you know, players that have played for you over the years. And so you get a little bit of that from Jim Calhoun, but your approach might be a little bit different.
Yeah, it's a little different.
So how do you push the guys? What's your kind of way of pushing a player who maybe, because I think of you and I think you've been through everything that one of these players now on the net roster, let's say, has ever been through. You're going to face guys who maybe have a little crisis of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's that? What's your message? How do you get through to those guys now, the modern day player?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back. It's simple. It's just spending time with them. You know, you can't go in and, you know, try to push somebody and you don't know them as a person. So just spending time with them, I think a great mentor, you know, you tell me what you want to accomplish and I'm going to challenge you on that each and every day. How do I know what you want to accomplish if I don't spend time with you and I don't ask you questions to get to know you? I think that's the biggest thing for me, just getting to know my players, understanding, you know, what makes them go, what they're committed to, what they're not committed to, and then just pushing them every day to that championship level. I call it level 5 energy. And I try to bring that level 5 energy in everything I do, and I think it's kind of contagious. Like if I'm on the court, like I'm dripping in sweat. Like I'm not this coach that's gonna sit on the side. Like I'm out here with you. You know, I'm expending energy with you. And I think that's the biggest thing I've been able to, you know, have a rapport with my players because I'm out there with them. I think I get some credibility by being in the league for 13 years, being a coach. There's definitely some credibility in that. But at the end of the day, you know, they don't care about what you say to them. They don't care about what you do. They care about do you really care about them as a person? And I think that's where I had a rapport at the best because I've been there. I've had the doubts, you know, I had the dissertations where I had the negative thoughts, I had the discouragement, I had the division, I had the disappointments, I had all those, you know, I call them the 5 D's, but what's on the other side of those 5 D's? The trust, you know, speaking life into yourself, no matter what's going on in your mind, you have a choice. I always said, you know, between stimulus and response, it's a space in between there where you have a choice to decide, you know, are you going to react in a survival mindset, or are you going to respond in a growth mindset? And in that little time, in that little space, and if you can expand that space, now you can make decisions with a clear mind. I think sometimes we just react and we anger or we disappointed, and those emotions become who we are. I don't want emotions are just emotions. They come up, they come and go like a storm. And I always want to tell our players that it's just a moment in time, but those emotions are there to help you and push you to the level, but those emotions are not you. And, you know, I had plenty of times where I got cut or they said I wasn't good enough, but that was just emotion. You know, I didn't let that become the condition around me. I didn't let that be my conclusion, you know, and that's why I want to tell all these players, like, whatever condition you're in, it's not your conclusion. You have a choice and a perspective that you can go and you can choose and not let life choose it for you.
Level 5 energy. I'm ready to go
now. Yeah, let's go.
You say 5 D's, I think of dodgeball, though. I think
dodgeball.
Very bad movie. Duck, dive, dodge, whatever. Yeah. Silly, stupid things. You know, is winning the motivation for a player or I've heard you speak about this before. It's like you gotta love the process. Does the process? So winning is sort of like a byproduct. Would that something that you would aspire to?
Yes, I mean, like I go back to UConn. That process of winning the national championship. I look back on it now. The confetti dropped. We back working 10 days after that. Mm. You know, like, yeah, the confetti dropped, but we back in the AAU watching from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. 10 days later. But it was just a process and, you know, just going through the ebb and flows of life, and you didn't give in. You know, you didn't give in as a team. You didn't give in as a coach. You sacrificed for the man that was next to you. I mean, all those different bonds that we have, what's what makes us. And, you know, just going through those situations, going through my NBA careers, being around some of the greatest players ever to, you know, lace them up, the Allen Iversons of the world and, you know, the Ray Allens of the world. I mean, I can go down a list, the Reggie Millers of the world, KDs of the world, being around those guys and see what they do each and every day. But then also being around, you know, the complimentary players, you know, the Jeff Greens of the world. You know, we talk about the big three, but you had Jeff Green there. You had Nick Collison there. You know, just being around certain teams and having those guys, the Aaron McKees, the Tyrone Hills, those guys make the superstars great too. And what they sacrifice really stuck out with me as well. So kind of having a lens with both areas really allowed me to shape my coaching philosophies and what I believe in and how I want to instill in the team. And, you know, being around the great assistant coaches that I've been around too, just how they serve and how they give their all for their head coaches, something that I always want to engrave into, you know, my coaching ability here at Brooklyn or wherever I, you know, find myself in the future.
Well, you're such a wealth of basketball. You're like a sponge that's taken in so much, absorbed so much. You're a great asset to have here in the organization. I appreciate you taking so much time with us. There's a lot of things. I don't want to keep you so much longer. We you know, talk about overtime elite and all that kind of stuff. Maybe another time. You know, working with young people. Just quickly, I mean, did that rejuvenate you a little bit, working with young people like that?
Oh, and, yeah.
You know, I know you said you were a disruptor, and Overtime Elite was a little bit of a disruptive thing.
Yeah, they radicals. They radicals over there, but good radicals.
Yeah.
They wanted to find a different way. It's always been the traditional way, going to college, but, you know, Dan and Zach over there at Overtime, and Brandon Williams was there when I first got there. They just came to me with this vision of starting Overtime Elite, being a disruptor, doing something that's never been done before, and having a transformative league that we were going to have 30 players from all different walks of the world, from Spain, from Serbia, from everywhere, from Atlanta, from California, from Oakland, from Florida, and we're going to bring these players together. These student athletes together and give them the tools to be successful, not only in basketball, but in life. And that kind of like geared right in towards me and allowing them to, you know, profit off of their sweat, you know, their sweat equity, having them profit off of it and allowing them to have a pro career. And that was the first year Overtime Elite. And then the second year we was allowed to have them come in and not only, you know, be pros, but keep their amateurism. It gave us two different pathways. So, you know, I thank Dan Porter and Zach and all those guys for giving me that opportunity. It was time for me to get back in after, you know, the different things I went through, UConn and arbitration and all that stuff, to get back in and really, you know, give my life back to basketball. And, you know, that's my sanctuary. And to see, you know, all of our players, the Twins, Iman and Asar, and all of our guys get 10-day, you know, two-way contracts, and, you know, the Jay Gortz of the world, and, you know, the Jalen Martins of the world, and Don Barlow's of the world, and, you know, all of our guys are still in the program. It means a lot to me. But at the end of the day, Chris, it's like, how many times in life do you get to associate your name with something that's never been done before? Not too many times. I don't know if I'm going to ever get another time like that. So I always talk about minimizing regret. That was another one. So when I turn 80, I'll be like, yeah, that was the reason why you did that one.
Just like the decision to go all the way across the country and play at UConn when it hadn't been the UConn we know yet.
Yep, that's right.
Doing that thing. Finally, before I let you go, so the Oculus outside Barclays Center, this video board that everybody can see, you know, when you come out of the subway, you walk around the town. You could put your personal mantra, something that the words you live by, something you can throw up there. You've given us a lot that we can choose from here throughout the course of it. But something that kind of encapsulates you, what you think it might be?
Joy now or never.
Joy now or never.
Yeah, joy is not a destination. Joy lives inside of you. Happiness lives inside of you. It's not a destination that you can get to. You can make up in your mind, in your heart, in your spirit every day to work up with joy. So joy now and never.
Love that.
Yeah.
So great to welcome you back to
Thank
the
you.
Nets. Thanks for being here, Kevin. Thanks
Thank
for doing
you.
This,
I appreciate
man.
It, Chris. Thank you.
My thanks to Kevin Ollie for joining us here on the program. Got a lot of good feedback last week for our conversation with Ian Eagle. And, you know, they took a clip of it and put it on the internet. The clip where he talked about the movie that made him cry, The Notebook. And Ian has a funny way of telling the story of where he was. Check that out. I got to admit, I've never seen The Notebook. I will check it out when I can. But I know the kind of the premise of it, lifelong love story. It's a segue into what I wanted to acknowledge here today is that recently we lost someone in the Nets family, Judy Resnick, a.k.a. Mrs. Whammy. She was married to Bruce Resnick, who, of course, is the Nets super fan. They're both Nets super fans, and Bruce is the one who stands behind the basket and gives the whammy to the other team when they're shooting free throws. And when you go to Barclays Center, you would see the two of them together, the turtlenecks with the jersey over them. And, you know, Bruce would have the big signs that he always made. And they would stop by our radio booth before the game to show us the signs. And they were an adorable couple. It was always great to see Judy right there next to Bruce. She was 87 years old. And they met when they were in high school. It's an incredible love story. And as Jimmy V said in his Never Give Up speech, we should all have our emotions moved to tears sometimes, that have those feelings. And to see them together all those years and now know that we won't see Judy with Bruce at the games anymore is sad. But she had a long, remarkable life. And our condolences go out to Bruce. Because when I heard this news, my first thought was, when I see Bruce, I'm going to have those feelings. Because to think about what he's going through and how kind he is and how great it is to see him at the games and how much joy he takes in being there and how much joy people get out of seeing him and talking to him. And now he won't have Judy around with him anymore is sad, but it's also something to be incredibly grateful for all the years they had together. So we will miss Judy Resnick, AKA Mrs. Whammy. Want to thank my producer, Steve Goldberg. Our engineer, Chelsea Jenkins. We'll talk to you again next week. Another edition of The Voice of the Nets. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing and giving us a good rating, reaching out to us on social media as well. My name's Chris Carino. Thank you so much. Talk to you again next week.